morning. Good morning. Good morning. All right, good. Hey, welcome everybody to the Experts Unplug session, which is kind of funny because we're all plugged in, we're amplified. What unplugged really means is this is an unscripted session. My name is Sean McGrath. I am a lead PM for the supportability team, and I'm up here with seven of my closest coworkers, and we're going to take you through, or you're going to take us through, a conversation around exchange top issues. Before we get started, though, I'd like my team to introduce themselves, and I'm going to have Nino start here.
Well, that's kind of loud. My name is Nino Bilic. I work out of the Dallas, Texas office. I have been with Exchange for about 15 years now, I guess. I cover areas of management, anything store, and typically mailbox-related, yes, public folders. Yeah, I guess I'll leave it at that.
I'm Scott Landry. I'm based in the Charlotte office, and I own things like mail flow, protection, and now security. And I've been with Exchange now for about 17 and a half years.
Okay, my name is Nasir Ali. I'm an escalation engineer. I'm also based out of Texas. And most of the time, I work is escalations, critical issues, performance issues, things that are down. So those type of things that comes to us when there's a crisis type of situation.
My name is Amir Haq, and I am a support lead PM responsible for client access, any Outlook client connecting to an Exchange mailbox, online or on-prem, and mobility areas.
My name's Gabe Breton. I'm a supportability PM for Outlook. It's desktop Outlook. So I cover issues ranging from consumer, commercial, and Office 365. So any questions on Outlook, this is my area.
Hi, my name's Angela Taylor. I cover compliance, so e-discovery, archiving, import service. Those are my areas, and I'm based out of Redmond.
I'm Timothy Heaney. I don't get to have a microphone on.
Yeah, you do.
I didn't sound like it. I'm working on hybrid migration, onboarding, and I'm based out of my basement in Austin, Texas.
Sorry. So now that you know a little bit about us, I actually would like to take a couple quick polls in the audience so we understand who we're talking to. So my first question is, with show of hands, how many people are running Exchange on-prem only?
Wow. All right.
Okay, now. Good for you. So of those people, just because there were so many, Exchange, raise your hands again. Now, how many people is running Exchange 2016? Okay, Exchange 2013? 2007? And 2003? 5-5? We skipped Exchange 2000, by the way. Okay, next question. Who here is running in a hybrid configuration? So some on-prem, some online. Okay?
Not as many.
Okay, who's all on the cloud? All right. Now, totally different question. Of those that have hybrid or Exchange online, how many of you contacted Microsoft support? Okay, keep your hands up. And keep your hands up if you've had a good experience. Okay. So some. All right, so thank you for that. That does give us a good perspective of who the audience is and maybe the type of questions that we'll receive. Before I go any further, though, I really want you to understand who you are talking to. As you heard, we're geographically dispersed across the United States. But one of the things that sets us apart as a supportability team versus the engineering team that you might be hearing a lot of at this conference, is we don't actually sit within engineering. We are actually part of CSS or support. And our role here is to gather feedback from a variety of sources. Those sources could be support data. It could be telemetry from the service. It could be user voice, forums, MVPs. We gather all this data to understand what the top issues are. And then we put together stories, customer experience journeys, tell the product team, partner with the product team, and share these experiences and stories with them. We then go and figure out how to resolve those issues. And then you'll see that in terms of, you know, it could be content, it could be a new tool, or even product improvements. So we have a couple of examples just to give you an idea of some of the things that the team has been doing behind the scenes. And I'll have Tim kick us off real quick.
Yeah, so a lot of you, I think, have been to the sessions around the hybrid configuration wizard. And if not, a lot of you, I saw the hands, a lot of you have used a hybrid wizard. We've come a long way, but in the past, I would say in the past year, because the new hybrid wizard came out about a year ago, we brought our first run failure rates from around 40% all the way down to basically 1%. I mean, we're making huge strides in that area, and our team is responsible for, I'm responsible for PMing that component. And you know, we did everything from bringing that failure rates down to improving the error experience to making sure we have the telemetry to understand what your experiences are like. Basically, it was designed with what we call supportability in mind, which means design with the customer in mind, right? It wasn't designed to just get you into hybrid and then drop the mic. It was designed to make sure that we understood what you were going through and made it better.
Okay. So another one here from Amir.
Yeah, so Gabe and I work with the Sarah team. And how many of you have seen or known Sarah? Okay. Cool. So we are going to have a session later today on and talk more about details on Sarah. Sarah is a tool which will help you in troubleshooting Outlook issues, if you'll keep clicking on that. And here are some of the scenarios which are available for Outlook. We work with the team, a team of about 11 developers, and we build all the analyzer or diagnostics behind it. One thing which it does also after diagnosing the problem is help you with the recovery or automated solutions so that a user of Outlook can just run it on its own if you point it towards that. It's available now, localized in 20 different languages all around the world. There are about 1,500 plus daily active users, and with a really good effectiveness rating. There's a built-in feedback mechanism, and you can see average feedback from users around 3.6 out of 5 stars.
Okay, and this is a story that I've been talking about now actually for several conferences, but since many of you are coming from Exchange 2010 on-premises, you may not have seen that we've been iterating and improving the NDR experience. NDRs are not that sexy typically. They're very difficult to read and understand. This is a time where we've actually, the transport team is a back-end infrastructure team. They don't really get in front of customers that often, end users that often. And here we've actually redesigned the NDR experience around the end user to make sure that the end user can quickly provide the information to the administrator. I was going to show some telemetry and you know how we do all this. Instead, two make it real examples, since this is the keeping it real section. Two examples from this week. I have been to multiple presentations this week where the engineering teams have actually showed off their NDR in a session. Something that you know previously might have been something that they weren't proud of or you know treated as an error, but they're you know, they're very proud of these new NDRs. Second example, somebody walked up to me at the booth and they said, I've got this issue, you know, here's the NDR. With the NDR, we were actually able to troubleshoot the issue right there on the spot with no other information. And we were able to do that because we've taken it from, you know, 30 or so NDRs that were very hard to understand to over 150 NDRs that are very actionable and specific. Furthermore, he even said, my 2016 users aren't getting this problem at all. And that's because we've taken that feedback and we've gone back to Outlook and we fixed Outlook so those NDRs don't even happen anymore. So anyway, some good keeping it real examples.
Thanks, Scott. So before we open it up for your questions and your comments, I want to mention we continually listen. I mentioned earlier that we do listen to user voice, and I wanted to note the two different user voice sites where you get to suggest things and then you get to vote up the things that matter most. Also on here is there's an alias, exchangefeedback@microsoft.com. We may ask you, depending upon the scenario today, to just send email to us directly so that we can follow up later. But it's exchangefeedback@microsoft.com. So with that, that's weird.
I know, right? Somebody did this on purpose.
Yeah, we don't mean to highlight modern public folders, but you know, it all should be white. Like, yeah, all the lettering should be white. So what we're going to do is really open it up for your comments and questions. This is an unscripted session. We do have content behind each of the 9 boxes. So if you want to talk about any one particular topic, we'll gladly click on that, and we can talk about what those top issues are and mitigations. Now, I have up here 10 1,024 megabyte USB drives that have the latest Tony Redmond book on Office 365 admin.
For IT pros.
Office 365 admin for IT pros. Now, based on the audience, it might be very handy, maybe in the future, not now. But this, again, 1,024 megabytes worth of content. 1 gig. Doesn't sound as big.
Over 1,000 megabytes.
Yeah, seriously. So with that, so any good question or anything, if you feel, we're going to pass these out. So questions from you, please come up to the microphone. There's one on each side here, and you're going to need to go up to the microphone. Yeah. Because this is being recorded and broadcast live on the app. So thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. We have a lot of disconnected mailboxes. If I want to migrate to Exchange 2016, how do I move them? We keep them for, instead of having a long-term backup, we can always restore the disconnected mailbox in case we need it.
So your goal is to migrate a disconnected mailbox?
Yes.
You can't migrate a disconnected mailbox. So you would have to, I guess, reconnect it and then migrate it? But why do you have, I don't get the use case.
Instead of having them stored anywhere else, we have a PLA installation, we have a lot of storage, so we just keep them there instead of taking them to some tape backup. Mm-mm. It's much faster for us to, in case we need to reconnect the mailbox, drag whatever information we need, and then disconnect them.
Is there a reason litigation hold wouldn't be a better option for you? So like, you know, reconnect the mailbox, move it to Office 365, put it on litigation hold, and then...
In this way, the actual AD account is gone. So we don't want to fill up the...
So I'll answer your question. You cannot move disconnected mailbox to Office 365. So you'd have to reconnect it to another user account to move it. Or you'd have to, I guess, reconnect it or export the data and then import it into Office 365, maybe using that PST import service.
Right.
Well, another thing that you could do possibly is convert them to shared mailboxes and then move those.
And a follow-up question is, can I search them without reconnecting them?
Sure.
Yes.
You can give other people permissions on a shared mailbox.
But if they are still disconnected?
Correct. Then if you give somebody rights to the shared mailbox, they can basically open the contents of the mailbox, right?
But not the disconnected.
Correct. They will not be connected to the primary account, so a shared mailbox will not be logging in directly, but a user that has full access rights will be able to log into that mailbox. That is basically how a shared mailbox works.
Okay.
Sure.
Thank you. We're going to switch back over here, this side.
Good morning. I wanted to share my organization's experience going to the cloud. We were on-prem 2010, 13 server. We went completely to the cloud, Office 365. It was an incredibly painful process. We are a small organization. We only have about 1,000 mailboxes, and it took us like over a quarter to get out to the cloud. There's some type of throttling mechanism where even though we have a gig out to the internet, we can't leverage that. So that was very painful. A year later, we're looking to go back on-prem, specifically because of the lack of customization or customability within the transport, like limiting mailbox or number of email messages within a specific time frame, things of that nature. And also the latency on administration is just horrible. A task that we can do on-prem in about 30 seconds can take us, you know, easily 2 or 3 minutes just because of the pages we have to go to and the lag.
Okay.
That's my feedback.
So, yeah. Let's turn that mic off.
But great feedback.
But regarding that feedback, I mean, how often do we hear some of that feedback?
I mean, I'll start at the beginning.
Yeah, go ahead.
With the migration bits, I'm not going to talk about the transport piece, but with the migration piece, you know, one of the things that does slow down migrations, I don't know your specific scenario, but one of the things that slows down migrations is our workload management processes that we have in the service. It's not necessarily throttling your bandwidth, but if you're doing moves, let's say you're doing moves during, we have to make a decision on, are we going to let our services use our processing power for client connectivity and mail flow, or are we going to let our servers use our processing power for moving a mailbox? Well, we should definitely give it to client connectivity and mail flow, because if you're in the process of moving, well, you're still connected and working just fine on-prem. So the idea is that we balance the load and favor those critical functions of the service and not migration. And that's likely what the, I'm going to air quote, throttling was that you faced, but again, without knowing more detail, I'm not sure.
Yeah. Sky, any comments about the transport?
I am interested to know exactly which settings, and I can follow up certainly offline on that. We do hear that feedback occasionally, and one of the things that we've been trying to balance between support and, of course, engineering, some of it is prioritization, but some of it is also, with a shared service, we don't want you guys, we can't allow everybody to have completely unlimited limits if you're talking about limits going higher. If you're talking about limits going lower, it's an interesting trade-off. We actually do, in some cases, allow people to set things lower, but we don't have a good configuration story for that today, and we need to fix that. We need to get the configuration story better. But even then, there's something to think about, which is if you're, if in Office 365 we're supporting, you know, really large mailboxes, really large messages, thousands of recipients, and we don't have a problem with any of that, and you're in turn enforcing a lower limit, it's one thing if it's obvious that you're protecting your organization from maybe phishing attacks or something like that, then that's great. On the other hand, it could also reflect back to the end user that Office 365 maybe, you know, isn't capable of those things. And so there's a bit of a balancing act there. So we've got a little bit of thinking to do to sort through that. But I would be interested to follow up on your specific scenario.
Sean, do you think that as a consolation prize, we should give them 1,000?
I actually thought about it. I have it right here, so. Tim, you should give it to him. Since you made that bad comment about the microphone.
So, I mean, as far as management goes, I am going to assume that you have seen slowness in the new admin portal. I am interested in hearing more details if that is the case or not. I know that the team has actually had an issue which was posted to the message center with the performance of the admin portal that was going on for about 2 weeks, where some customers were quite impacted by the performance, but it should not be universally true all the time. So, I mean, whether you move back or not, that is a separate story. But I mean, if you do have more details about exactly what is broken in the management, I would like to hear it later.
And we know that it's not even remotely possible that it could be networking related, right? Not even possible.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, Kat. Okay, we'll move over here.
Well, I hate to harp on performance, but my particular problem is kind of interesting, and I haven't found much online. We're in a hybrid situation, but all of our mailboxes are in the cloud. We've noticed that even when granting access to a mailbox with the PowerShell, on average, you have to wait 25 to 30 minutes before you can access that other mailbox. And I'm wondering if that's... Oh, yay, I'm not the only one, thank God. No one else has posted about it online. So I was wondering, is that typical behavior?
25 to 30 minutes. So you know that the permissions have been applied, and it takes you 25 to 30 minutes before a person can open using Outlook or?
Using Outlook or OAuth.
So this is basically universally true, I hear?
Okay. Yeah, I just couldn't find anything online or at all in regards to it, so I was just wondering, maybe it's just us, or...
It doesn't sound like it's online.
Okay, you're right.
Then it's probably us.
Okay. Awesome, thanks.
So I took a note of that.
Yeah,
and
took a note.
Definitely.
Thank you.
We'll take it back, yeah.
Yeah.
The first thing that popped into my mind, yes, but there's got to be a solution, right? I mean, yay, it's store cache. Then what?
That's not okay.
I mean, need to look into it.
It also could be ADFS. If you're doing ADFS, it could be your sync delay or something.
And ADFS shouldn't affect a permission.
On a mailbox.
Yeah. We'll definitely be following up. Do you have a comment about this particular scenario?
So it actually differs from tenant to tenant. I see.
So
have you noticed? I don't know. Is there some sort of commonality? I don't know. Tenant in this region versus tenant in the other region, or whatever.
No, I'm not. That many numbers to compare.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, over here.
All right. So I actually have three questions. Probably two of them are very simple. We do hybrid. We don't want to complicate things by adding load balancers on each site. We have two sites. What are the options you guys have to dynamically load balance emails coming from EOP to my hybrid?
Honestly, the best thing is you can use a load balancer on-prem in front of multiple hybrid servers. That is something that we absolutely support.
Hybrid servers.
Going beyond that gets a little bit too complicated. I think you want to keep it really simple, and you want to just basically do simple port load balancing and nothing super complicated like inspection or anything like that. And I'm working on actually a blog post as to why that is. But yes, you can absolutely do that. Something else that I will point out is if you are a really large organization and you've got maybe one or two hybrid servers, there is an issue. And actually, Tim, you're probably upset that I'm using the term hybrid server.
No, not at all.
So, let's say you have a bridgehead, and it's primarily doing hybrid related functions, routing. There are some tweaks that I can follow up with you that you can make to improve the performance going from on-premises to the cloud. Shouldn't be seeing any problems whatsoever in the opposite direction, if you've got load balancing or whatever. But in the other direction, we do see some problems, and there's some tweaks that I can recommend.
So without a load balancer, there's nothing much we could do, is what you're saying?
On the inbound side?
Yeah.
You could use DNS round robin, honestly, you could. There's no reason for SMTP that it has to be stateful. You may not see exactly 50-50 load balancing, of course, but DNS round robin would be a cheap way to accomplish that, because we don't have any kind of session requirement.
Okay, yeah, that's all right. A security related question. We have proxies in our environment. We have Blue Coat servers and all that stuff. Since you guys really want us to open star.outlook.com or star.whatever.com, how do we make sure that the personal or other business tenants are not accessible from the corporate network?
I can speak to transport. From a transport perspective, and this will be in this blog that I'm working on, actually, one of the reasons that we are recommending Exchange be the thing that you use to connect your port 25 traffic, one of the reasons that we're doing that is because we actually have the ability to inspect and know that, and to route traffic differently based upon which tenant it's coming from. And we can do that because we've built that into the product. We've built that into on-premises, we've built that into the cloud, okay? And so if you put something else in between there that's doing stateful inspection or a store and forward routing, it would have to understand that. And it's not rocket science, it's not something that we couldn't document, but routing is already a complex enough problem. And so there's no reason to introduce more complexity, more security risk, and so that's why we make that recommendation.
So that's for the transport side. What happens to the browser layer? How can we restrict people opening OWA from other tenants?
Yeah, so I mean, the Outlook services, consumer and business services essentially use the same endpoint is the challenge, right? It's essentially, if you want to, you wouldn't be able to stop a specific browser access for one, for consumer versus business. It's not something, we used to offer that because it was separate URLs for, you know, our consumer side. It's no longer a separate URL, so that's, we have it documented that you have to open it up to those endpoints because it's not separated anymore. The way you do it, I guess, would be to, you know, have ADFS. It wouldn't stop you from getting to the URLs, but it would make sure that you're off on-prem and things like that. But.
Okay. The other question is, why does ActiveSync take so long after you disable an account? It doesn't really honor the disable.
ActiveSync taking long for what?
So basically, when you disable an account, on-prem or wherever, right? I have ActiveSync configured on my phone. It doesn't really honor your disable immediately because I think it has a back-end partnership with your mailbox, the device partnership. It does not really honor it immediately. I think there's a blog post where like it says 8 hours to 24 hours or whatever, but
yes,
it also talks about you can reset your IIS and all that.
There you go.
It's no, you cannot reset an IIS. So
the reason for that is because ENS connection is going through a virtual directory under IIS, and IIS does cache password, right? So are you talking about an on-prem environment?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's where it's being cached, and Exchange does not have control over that piece. So that's why a common solution is reset that. And you can do that. So are you disabling or enabling user during the daytime, the work hours? No, right? I'm assuming
it's
that you do it on the
termination
downtime, right? On a downtime or on a weekend.
No, it's a termination process you do it any time of the day, depending on what it is.
Got it. There are other ways to block access to a user account before it gets to a protocol level. Try looking over there. So for example, at the platform Windows authentication layer, rather than thinking about that, hey, if my user can come in, then I need to disable access at the protocol level for an Exchange mailbox, right? So make sure that the user is simply not able to authenticate at the Windows level, rather than looking at the protocol level.
But ActiveSync does not even relate to Windows authentication at that point. It's about the device partnership that's already in.
So terminate that partnership on the server side and block the device ID. There is a blog post on that as well. that list all the different steps. Send me an email or sync up with me later, and then I'll walk you through those steps. Okay? That's what he's doing.
Yeah. 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 Not an ideal, perfect solution. Realize that. But it is a series of workarounds right now.
And it is documented on TechNet.
Yes,
it is documented.
It
is. Yeah. So
I think even disabling protocol will take some time because there is a cache that's kept on the mailbox. It's not doesn't kick in immediately. There is even a delay there right there.
So that's what we are saying, that because of that known issue and limitation, because of IES caching password, there are other ways to go around that, right? So block, it is the device, block the device ID using the device ID, and all the steps are in the block. I'll give you the link for that, okay?
Cool. And the lady that actually asked a question about the delay, the one before me, someone was actually telling on one of your sessions yesterday, when a mailbox get disconnected on a cloud environment, it's available immediately for a reconnect. So how do you guys do that? Do you guys do clean mailbox database all the time in the back end, or how do we manage that delay? How is it available immediately?
I don't know that I understand.
So I guess what you mean is if the license is removed from a user, if Exchange license is removed from a user, the mailbox goes into soft deleted state, right? And then basically if you re-add the Exchange Online license to that user within next 30 days, we're going to reconnect that mailbox. Right.
So that's next 30 days, but somebody said it's immediate. In one of your sessions, I think you were there in that session, it's available immediately.
So when you delete a user, you're saying? Or
disable a user.
If you disable a user, it goes into a disconnected state,
right.
You can immediately reconnect it. Yeah.
But that's usually not the case. You have to do a clean mailbox database to get the cache out. And because it won't even show up in the disconnected mailboxes, honestly.
You're talking about off-premise or Office 365?
Yeah,
no, this is Office 365. We're actually moving to Office 365. We still have a good on-premise environment, user environment.
When I say immediate, I mean it might not be 100% immediate, but I've gone through, and as fast as I can type the commands, it reconnects in Office 365.
Right.
So immediate's a relative term, but it's pretty immediate, unless you're a fast typer.
Cool. Fair enough. Thanks.
Yep.
Okay. All right. Over here.
Hi. We're running Exchange 2013 CU11 on premise, and ever since we've upgraded, we're now got rid of all our 2010 servers. We run 2012 R2 Active Directory controllers. Our main issue that we've experienced is name changes, like somebody gets married, somebody did a misspelling, whatnot. When you go to the ECP, it changes all the attributes in Active Directory other than the NetBIOS 2000 name. But everything else gets changed. So is this a bug or is this something that we can change in our environment, because it's then generating lots of tickets for us to go through as administrators to correct that in Active Directory because it breaks the account.
Did you see this issue after applying CU11 or it was there before?
We went from 2010 to 2013,
okay.
And we no longer have any 2010.
No. What I'm saying is that you're saying that you're on CU11, right?
Correct.
So is that issue was right after the move, was always there, or did you notice it after applying a service cumulative update?
I noticed it after we went from 2010 to 2013 CU11.
Oh, so they went straight to CU11.
Okay. So I have not actually seen this particular thing you're talking about, in terms of, a known bug. But you are on CU11, so which is a three CU, basically down, I would say 9 to 12 months old. So you may want to look into the newest CUs to see if there is anything different in there. But I have not seen this particular issue in terms of, what you described.
You have or have not?
I have not seen.
Okay.
I have not seen. So one of the things that you can do is that you can open a ticket with us and we can look into it to figure out what it is that you're encountering. Maybe this is something very specific to your organization or configuration, Maybe there's something that we need to do, but I have not seen any known bug on this particular.
This is when you're managing through the UI, right?
Yes, through the ECP.
Okay, but if you go through PowerShell and you only touch one attribute,
it boom, it goes right through.
Okay. I think that is actually expected, but because I've seen that behavior myself. You know, because basically, if you've got this UI, you know, where you've got all the different fields and everything, we'd have to track every possible field and what's changed and what's not, versus just saying this UI element.
Right. The issue is that our desktop support does not have they have the ability, but
right.
Obviously they're not going to be running PowerShell as administrators.
Right. Right. Okay. I think we understand the issue now. It's just a question of following up on it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thanks.
And the only other issue that we have is that when contacts are created through the UI, it puts it into the default user's area. It's grayed out when it lets you choose the Active Directory path. Is there a setting in Exchange that we need to enable so that's not grayed out anymore?
I don't know that I understand the...
We create contact.
Okay, contacts, right?
Yes. You go through, enter all the information, and then at the bottom there is a path for the Active Directory path. It's grayed out.
You mean OU?
Correct.
Okay.
It just puts the new contacts into the actual users OU.
Users OU.
The general users OU. Is there something that we have not enabled correctly so that would not be grayed out?
I actually don't know. Did somebody say yes, there is?
Yeah, role-based access control.
Oh, so this is RBAC?
Okay.
Well, sounds like there's a solution here.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry, I actually didn't know about this one. Cool.
Maybe this one's going to give some love to the Outlook client people up on the panel. So our company has a use case to where the users at the campuses very often undock their laptop, bring it to the meeting room, open it up, reconnect, go from wireless back to the docked location. And what we find is a lot of the users report that Outlook doesn't reconnect. It's not very responsive in how often it reconnects or how soon it reconnects when the network state transitions. And as a result, someone might go from a meeting wireless, they'll dock their laptop again, Outlook will remain open the whole time, and the users will compose some messages, click send, walk away from their desk. They'll speak to the person that they sent the messages to 2 hours later, and they never receive the messages. They're still stuck in the outbox, right? So I'm wondering if you can discuss a little bit how Outlook client, Outlook 2016 CTR is what we're using, how it uses network location awareness to determine to go online and offline.
Yeah, I mean, that's not really, you said you're on Outlook 2016, click to run, current channel, latest updates.
We're actually on the deferred channel.
Okay. Yeah, deferred channel is a little dated, so I would definitely recommend considering current channel. I mean, that's not, you know, I know in the past that we've had issues where, you know, Outlook won't reconnect after coming out of the sleep state of the computer, for example. But as general practice, that's not, you know, an issue that, you know, I'm seeing a lot of reports on these days.
I'm wondering if it might be related at all to maybe the way that we've set up the wireless access points for the company, because
okay.
I'm not sure if this is unique to our company or not, but for example, the laptops use certificate-based authentication to automatically connect to the predefined wireless access point, but they're not yet officially on the network. Full internal DNS resolution works, but until they open up a wireless captive portal page, an RSA in, they're not actually able to connect to those endpoints, but DNS resolution still does resolve for, you know, the endpoint FQDNs that are in like the auto-discover XML file. So I'm wondering if that has, if that's throwing Outlook into some kind of strange mode when it's going on and off the wireless. Maybe it, maybe not, but.
Yeah, I think it could be.
What happens to other applications like IE or anything else that's been run on the machine?
There's no issues with those. For example, like if you're on wireless, you bring up an IE, go to Google, it automatically brings up the captive page,
okay.
you opt in, and then you go to Google.
Okay. The reason I ask, because IE or the browsers or Chrome are using a different module at the Windows network layer, WinHttp versus WinINet. And we have seen this issue, for example, when the protocol switches from IPv4 to IPv6. And we have seen some issues with IPv6 connectivity. And when we investigated those, it was the switching thing. So I don't know if you guys know, there is a happy eyeball technology which has been implemented in Chrome to make sure that when the protocol switches from IPv4 to IPv6, the switchover for the browser is also seamless. So we brought that issue up with the Outlook team. So I'm wondering if it relates to that, that browsers are working and Outlook is not working, so does it relate to the us using WinHttp module. I haven't heard, like Gabe, I haven't heard this as a common issue, so it's not being actively investigated. If you can open a support case, ping us through email, we can have it investigated and take those factors also into account.
Last
that you
question
mentioned.
Related to that, in a perfect scenario, perfect topology, what's the expectation for an Outlook client that's undocked, not on the wireless network, when you redock it and Outlook is open? What's the expectation of time frame that Outlook would be able to reconnect and then send any mails or queues?
Within seconds. I do that all day, every day. I use my laptop all the time at home, dock, undock, at work. I just flip it open and it works. I don't have to restart anything. A customer on the floor also brought it up, and he said that I have to restart the machine to make sure that Outlook works now. Had the similar symptoms that you mentioned. And I mentioned to him that, hey, you don't even have to restart Outlook. So if you're restarting Windows, then problem is somewhere outside of Outlook at the Windows or platform level. Or maybe it could be the network switching and stuff. So let's call in, let's create a case and have it investigated.
I would also test having another machine with Outlook 2016 click to run with current channel, because I mean, the Outlook team has done a lot of work to kind of address these scenarios. I mean, at RTM, I definitely recall, we spent a lot of time dealing with, what happens when you go to Starbucks and bring up your laptop there and dealing with all kind of connectivity scenarios. So, I know
RTM tells us that the current channel is beta and says go to the deferred. Should I tell them what you said?
Yeah, I mean, you can have a TAM contact me. I mean, the deferred channel, that's really, I mean, that is something important for people that, have a lot of application, issues, can't, move as fast, where they constantly have to test to make sure there's compatibility, with older applications that they have in their environment. But for standard use, I mean, click to run, it gets all the latest fixes. It's not, what you would think of as beta, because we have insider first release fast and first release slow. And those are the more where you're getting what the dev team's running. Current channel, it's already got multiple rings that have already been released, so it's pretty, it's very reliable. And a lot of times what I see is, because I watch in the forums a lot, and a lot of people that are posting about issues and bugs, a lot of things are, it's something that was fixed already in current channel, and they're still in deferred channel. I mean, I could tell you just a ton of bugs that I know that are still in deferred channel, because it takes a product team a lot of effort to go. And, if they find a bug and get that ported over to deferred channel, it's a separate task. And then also, from month to month, you're only getting security updates, and every 4 months getting major feature updates, but that's not every single feature and every single bug fix. It's just mainly, larger targeted features. So that's why,
Can you even keep just one or two machine on that as an administrator to quickly check things and verify if it happens over there, right? So it will be easier, good information to us for us to have that it does not work.
Thank you.
Cool.
Thanks. Okay.
I'd like to just preface my question a little bit with a gentleman who had the other issue before with a sour experience migrating to the cloud. you know, it's important to know if you migrated using the Microsoft methodology going hybrid, or if you use a third-party tool, and if that tool used EWS, or if it used MAPI, that will definitely affect your speed and throttling. So, I mean, I work for Netmail, that's what we do, and if you want to know more, you could find me at the Netmail booth. But it's just important to know, people don't understand there's so many ways to go, and he didn't mention which way he took, so. And if you want to get off the cloud for some reason, you're hell-bent on it, we could help you with that, too. But on a similar vein, one of the things that we see at Netmail when we're trying to pull data in and out of mailboxes, we use EWS, and one of the things I encounter pretty often is the error, item not found in the store. You know, and we'd get the item subject line, for example, or whatever it is, maybe the attachment, and I can go into the mailbox via OWASP, find it, no problem, open it up, you know, and then I'm at a loss as to why I can't pull this out with EWS. So I don't understand, maybe you could give me a little bit of insight about how this works, how they're connected, why OWA can find it and EWS can't.
I think your question is really, did you have a developer support case open for this? I think this is where it really belongs.
No, I don't think we did, because I always assumed that the problem is not on our software, but on the Exchange side, because that's the error came
and
from
that's
Exchange,
fair.
Right?
So and that is fair. However, you know, you're accessing things that typically clients don't, and that is where you are seeing an error, and you know, it could be our bug, but it's not going to necessarily show up in the clients that we make, right? So I would encourage you to open actually a support case with the, we do have a developer, messaging developer support.
Yeah.
I think that's where it should go.
And just to be fair, even with the native migration tools, you can run into challenges where you can't move an item. Happens all the time. We have a default, you know, setting of you skip 10 items, right? So, I mean, it's normal. That item is corrupt. And what corrupt means is something's wrong, right? We don't know what it is. Doesn't mean you can't open it. Doesn't mean it's not there. It's just something's wrong and we can't move it. It is called corrupt because we don't want to give a better definition.
Yeah. No, I know.
It could be it too.
I've tried some of the basics because obviously I couldn't just throw my hands up at it and I had to do something. So I would do stuff like a mailbox move to another database in the hope that I might scrub some of that bad data. But then I'd get it again on the other side.
So you're
like,
saying
it's there. I know it's there.
So you're saying our native moves can move it, but yours can't?
Damn, I think you.
Okay, I'll open a case with support. Thank you.
Yeah. Over here.
Yeah, I have a question about Exchange 2013 on-prem. Currently, for our litigation hold, we're using a third-party tool, uses kind of the traditional journaling approach. And we'd like to try the Exchange litigation hold. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas how we can handle people that are termed. This was kind of touched on in one of the other sessions for the online, but on-prem, basically what we run into is an employee is termed, their ID is deleted, and the mailbox is soft, deleted at that point, stored for I think about 30 days in our system, and then it's gone. Is there any way to differentiate those users that are on litigation hold? You know, I'm thinking right now we'll have to run some sort of process that finds them and reattach them to a non-user ID or something like that. I was just wondering if there was a different possible solution when it comes to termed users for on-prem.
So you're saying they were already on litigation hold when you removed them?
Yeah, so they're on litigation hold. They're part of some legal case, and we'll need to retain the data for a number, usually it's a number of years. That person leaves the company, and then under our current system, as soon as they're disabled, the mailbox is hidden, and about 2 weeks later, the AD object is deleted. Then about 30 days after that, the soft deleted mailbox is gone. So I'm just wondering if there's some way in Exchange, you know, I can think of some ways we can do this, possibly working with our AE team, that we could flag that so that it doesn't go through the standard.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, it sounds like you need a process for the case where if those accounts are being deleted, that there needs to be a check if this is on litigation hold or not, right?
So, because, yeah, I mean, so it would be on the AD side.
Because ultimately, it's, as far as exchange is concerned, it's really some properties on the account, right, that tell you that this is on litigation hold, and deletion of Active Directory account is out of our hands, right?
Sure. It's,
so I think you need a change in the process.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
Okay, over here.
Three words: hybrid public folders. I thought they were hard to deal with beforehand. We're finding that as we have our hybrid public folders, so a little history. We were a 2007 shop. We went to the cloud. We stood up 2013. Following kind of the legacy coexistence, it worked. However, I tended to find that there wasn't a lot of documentation around really troubleshooting the connection. And any error message I got was, can't expand folder, server not available, even though I knew the servers were up and my hybrid was working. We eventually moved to those public folders to 2013 so we could start to decommission our 2007 environment. But now that I've found that they're on 2013, I'm not finding a lot of information on how I actually eventually move those to the cloud. So am I like in a dead end somewhere where I can't find the documentation, there is a process, or is moving 2013 public folders to the cloud not an option yet? And then finally, can we get some kind of support document around how does that connectivity work and how do you troubleshoot problems? As an example, we rolled out the CU13 just the day before I got on the plane. Mm-hmm. As a result, it zeroed out the GUID of 500 users, the Exchange GUID for 500 users on-premise, not in the cloud. And those users couldn't access the public folders. But again, the only error we got was, can't expand public folders, server not available. So my experience with this is that it's kind of obscure, and there's not a lot of documentation around how it works, how to troubleshoot, what goes on behind the scenes to make that connection work.
So we could have a session just based on everything you just said, I think. Okay, going back, having public folders on 2013 or 2016 on-premises is not a dead end. I don't know if you are checking Exchange Team blog, but we had recently, within last 2 weeks, there was a blog post calling customers that want to help us test the migrations from 2013. And 16 to Exchange Online. So if you are interested, I think you can still apply. If you don't want to, that's okay. But one thing you can take away from that is that it's coming. Now, as far as the connectivity and troubleshooting some of the public folder things, I agree that documentation is not as extensive as on you know, when it's related to older versions. There are actually some efforts going on where we will be posting some things. There are some things being written currently that go into the area that you're talking about. So I would expect probably, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 weeks that we're gonna start releasing some of those things, and that should help, I hope. If not, that email would be good. You can just say for Nina or public folders. If it's public folders, nobody else is going to touch it. And as far as the zeroed out GUIDs, I don't know, Tim?
Do what piece now?
I'm sorry?
I didn't hear which piece you want.
GUIDs that zeroed out on users.
CU13, it zeroed out the Exchange GUID for 500 of our users.
Yeah. It's an unfortunate circumstance that happens when you install CU, the latest CU.
Yeah, we found that out. But it was funny that the only problem that it really presented was that it hit the public folders. It just prevented public folder access.
It affects two things when you install that CU. It affects, because you're zeroed out on your GUIDs, it affects public folder access, and it affects free busy access if you're using OAuth.
Oh, okay.
So if your cloud user is a mailbox in the cloud and looks up an on-premises user's free busy, they it will fail. If OAuth is enabled, so you would have to disable OAuth until we get a CU that resolves it, which, God willing, will be the next CU.
Yeah, and to be clear, we were told by support that CU14 will correct the issue.
CU14 is already released, so it will be in the next CU.
Okay. Most likely, yeah. Thank you.
And you got a consolation prize of a.
Thank you.
Okay, over here.
My question's based on migration. So we are currently on-prem looking to go to 365. We have an on-prem AD as well as Azure AD using Azure Connect. Would I be able to go direct to Exchange Online? I've been hearing people say that I would need a server in between there, that I'd need like an Exchange server on-prem in order to be using Exchange Online with Azure AD.
You're going from what version of it, Ron?
We have 2013, CU 6 or 7.
And your question is after you move all your mailboxes?
Well, before, like we're looking to move to 365, mm-hmm. but we've been told that we need some sort of server still on-prem. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if that's true.
It is. What happens is when you have directory synchronized, when you install directory synchronization, are you planning on keeping directory synchronization around?
For the time being.
Okay, for the time being, you've decided that you want your source of authority to be on-premises then.
Yeah.
So as long as you keep directory synchronization around and you decide that you want your source of authority to be on-premises, you have to manage Exchange from on-premises. The tool that we have for managing Exchange on-premises is Exchange. So you need to keep that tool on-premises so that you can manage the recipients and things like that. Now, why is that? The reason is in the cloud, there's a few attributes such as a hide from address list, which you might or might not care about, email address, things like that that you cannot modify directly in the cloud because they are locked out. You have to do it on-prem for a synchronized user as long as their sync is currently activated. Okay? So you have two options. One is tell none of your employees to get married.
You know?
Or divorced, which might be a trickier one. Or have an Exchange, just in all seriousness, have an Exchange server on-prem so you can manage it. We are working on, or trying to come up with solutions for getting rid of the requirement for EAC. You'll notice if you try to create a tenant called nomoreac.onmicrosoft.com, it's taken. That's mine. We're trying, so yeah, I hope that answers it.
Thank you.
And by the way, is there, how do I say this? Is there something, is there a reason why you're still running that very, very, very old version of CU?
Yeah, the consultant that set it up didn't set it up properly. When we try to upgrade, it breaks our Exchange system. So we have to move towards a better solution.
Thanks. Yeah.
Huh. Yeah. Over here.
Well, Paul Cunningham and Tony Redmond are my two favorite MVPs, so that's the, I'm just here just for the USB drive. I'm just kidding. I'm really not kidding, but I do have a question. We are a service provider, so I have a client that, so to paint a very brief picture, Forest A, Forest B. Forest A is 2010 hybrid, completely in the cloud. Acquired Forest B, Microsoft migrated their Active Directory to Forest A, so now we have linked mailboxes, 2010 and Forest B. My question is, are without using Netmail, is linked mailboxes supported to migrate directly to Office 365 from 2010, or do I need to do what my plan is to do a cross-forest migration into Forest A and then on into 365?
I like your plan better than attempting to move linked mailboxes. Linked mailboxes, you can technically do it. It's blogged, and it would. I'm not going to bore everybody with the details, but it is blogged on how to do it. Not EHLO. I don't remember the link to the blog, but it starts with HTTP. but anyway, I like your idea better because I think it makes your identity management cleaner.
Right.
I think it makes your recipient story cleaner. And I think for the long term, that is the more challenging thing to maintain. So yeah, maybe you can make it a little easier to migrate your users, but then you're going to be fumbling through that recipient management for the foreseeable future. So go with your plan.
Right. And Forest B is going away. It's a total acquisition. So they're going to assume different, they're going to all come together as far as email addresses and names and so forth. So
yeah, I like your plan.
Thank you.
Thanks. Go ahead.
routing outbound email based on sender's domain. Is there an easy way?
So in Office 365, absolutely. I'm assuming the question is about on-premises. Right. That's actually a takeaway for me. I'm going to go back and figure out. There were some good reasons why we didn't implement that in 2013. Those good reasons are pretty much annihilated in 2016. So I'm going to go back and work with the devs and figure out if we can port that to on-premises. In the meantime, I did write a transport agent, routing rule agent. It basically allows you to use rules just like conditional-based routing would in the cloud. It's, of course, unsupported, you know, free code that you can manipulate and use yourself. But let me see if we can get you to a more supportable solution.
Thank you.
Yeah. Here.
So we have been running hybrid for about 3 years, and we have finally moved all our mailboxes up into Exchange Online. We're looking at removing the hybrid configuration. However, we still have applications on-premise that relies on, I guess, the Exchange servers to kind of relay email out to the internet and to our internal mailboxes up in the cloud. Is there any workaround or any way around this issue kind of thing if we were to remove hybrid configuration?
Basically, you just need a connector. I'm assuming, are we talking mostly devices?
No, they're actually applications that do not support basic authentication.
So they don't support basic auth?
Yeah.
You just need a connector, and that connector can be the hybrid connector, and maybe that's what you're using today. Or after, if those connectors go away, just basically you need something almost identical to it. The only limitation I will say is I'm assuming these applications also probably don't work with TLS and certificates. So you wouldn't be able to install a certificate and use a specific certificate. So we would be using IP address.
Okay.
We have a change coming that has been blogged about, and I'm just kind of doing a public service announcement. We have a change coming where you will no longer be able to send as an email address that you do not own, that you have not verified in the cloud. That's the only thing that you'll be limited as far as using IP versus certificate. But yes, absolutely, you can continue to use that.
Okay.
I want you to clarify something real fast. When you say you want to get rid of the hybrid configuration, are you trying to keep it to where you just have Exchange for like recipient management, but none of like the auto-discover, no federation, none of that
That's
stuff?
That's right, yeah.
You can totally get rid of all that stuff. There's a document on TechNet. If you just do a search for decommission, how and when to decommission hybrid, there's three different scenarios. Find the appropriate one. It talks about SMTP relay.
Okay.
Follow that one, and it'll tell you exactly what to do.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks.
Hi, everybody. Thanks. I have two questions. Hopefully, one of them will be simple. The other one, maybe not so. We empower our users by using universal security groups for mailbox permissions. And we have a tool that actually the users go to a website and they can add or remove users from that for the mailbox permissions. We're starting to roll out archive mailboxes, and it doesn't appear, we're on Exchange 2010, latest CU, it doesn't appear that users can't access the archive mailboxes if they're in a security group. We've been having to add the users directly on the mailbox. Do you know if that's changed in any of the later releases or?
Specifically for archive.
Yeah. I'm not aware of that issue, so I have not a clue. But if you follow up with me after the session, let me get some more details, and I can look into that for you.
Okay. The other question I have has to do with we're Exchange 2010, latest CU, and we have users with Outlook 2010 primarily. And we have a virtual environment, like a VDI environment, where users connect into a data center using a lightly managed device, and they open up Outlook. We don't use cache mode for those users. It's a decision that they've made in the VDI environment. Users will open up Outlook, and it fails to Outlook Anywhere, and users will sometimes connect to the wrong data center. Well, they were, and we had to make a bunch of changes to our client access arrays. But because of the, in our Outlook client, there's like settings that say if the user's connected on a slow network connection or a fast network connection to use different types of connectivity. And these, randomly, the users will just use Outlook anywhere instead of connecting over RPC or whatever. And I've been unable to figure out why. And it seems when they do fall over to Outlook anywhere, their experience is really poor. Have you guys seen anything like that? Is there anything that we can look at to try and correct that issue? I have opened a case with the support, but I've been unable to get there because it's not consistent.
So there are history keys to actually force Outlook to use MAPI versus RPC or HTTP, and you can just put those history keys to see what happens then. So you can force Outlook to use whatever mechanism you're requiring or you need. Did support tell you about those?
No.
It's publicly documented. Look it up, how to force. So those checkboxes have history keys behind them, okay? And you can force Outlook to use one of the two mechanisms as you desire. And do that and see how that works out for you. Okay.
All right, thank you.
Cool.
Great. Hi, my question is, I'm in a hybrid organization, and we are actively looking for a way to control active sync connections to the Exchange servers. So on-premise, you can control that by modifying IIS settings. But obviously, once you're in the cloud, you don't necessarily have that control. So do you have any recommendations or know if there is a way to be able to control that? We have a third-party MDM solution, and I know we're the company already invested in the solution, so we're not using Intune. So do you have any recommendations regarding that?
So you have Office 365 and a third-party MDM?
Correct.
Okay. So we don't have any statement saying that third-party MDMs are not supported. Are you running into any specific issue?
Well, so what we would like to do is force people who go to who are trying to connect to mail on their mobile devices to be forced to log into our MDM server and register.
Yes.
So we're simply trying to redirect them so that they can't immediately connect. Mm-hmm. I mean, I understand that you can control, you know, their active sync settings, you know, turn off that protocol, et cetera, but then it becomes a game of trying to chase down, you know, which types of apps are being connected, et cetera. So we're trying to kind of get to it through a
totally
more
So yeah, this question came up on the floor as well. So I have read a workaround. So when I got to hear about this issue first time, I went to the third-party MDM websites to see what are they advising their customers, right? Because they want their customers to help in this solution, right? And I saw that they're advising their customers to use a specific URL and give that URL to the through their end users. Hey, use this URL to set up your accounts. It is manual, not preferred, but that was a long time ago. We don't have any specific recommendation in this regard because we are expecting the third-party MDMs to provide guidance as you're using their solution, but I think we need to have some guidance. So I'll be working to put some guidance about. That's the thing which I found, a manual thing that you need to communicate this out to your users that, hey, use this URL rather than the Outlook URL for Office 365 to configure and put link that URL to your MDM front end so that they always go over there.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. All right, we have about 6 minutes left, so go ahead, over here.
Back on the situation where we have our AD on-prem and so we have all our accounts in the cloud. And there are some situations where we do need to change the UPN SAM account name. We're not quite sure how to do that without breaking the account and updating the proxies with the correct address. Can you point me to a tech blog or appropriate steps on doing that?
How are you, what are you seeing when you change it on-prem? Is it being reflected in the cloud?
Right, so we haven't actually gone through that yet. We're kind of new on Exchange. And we do have a case where we need to change a user's UPN because of a situation. So we're not sure what the proper way of doing that is without breaking their account.
Are the UPNs that you use in the cloud and on-prem the same?
Yes.
So you don't have like a .local on-prem and something else in the cloud, right? So you should be able to manage them directly in on-premises? and it should synchronize to Office 365. There were changes a couple months back. It's not 100% consistent against all tenants because there were changes a couple months back where you would have to do a set MSOL commandlet to fix a UPN. So you'd have to fix it on-prem and then run set MSOL, set MSOL user principal name or something to fix it in the cloud. It's something like that. And you'd have to fix it, or you could do it through the UI as well. The challenge is that we fixed that so that now when you sync the right UPN, but we didn't want to overwrite everybody's UPN if they were using the old method. We didn't want to break them. So you might see if you're an older tenant that you have to go and run set MSOL user principal name. If you're a newer tenant, you just set it on-prem. Safest thing to do is set it on-prem, go get yourself a bite to eat, you know, relax a little bit, come back, check it out, see if it's fixed. If it's not, run the set MSOL command, and you'll be good to go.
I guess more so how do you do it on-prem? Because when we change the UPN, it doesn't update the proxy, so what I've ran through is that you have to disable the account without running a sync, and that clears out all the attributes, and then you can re-enable the remote mailbox and it puts the new attributes in. Is that the correct way to do it?
Usually if you set an attribute on a user, it should update on that user. One thing you can do to kind of force things along a little bit is, I don't know if there's a better term, but besides tickle the user, don't physically do that, you might get in trouble. But the you go and add an attribute to the user, street address, anything to the user, and force it to kind of update that user and see if that helps. But honestly, just putting your UPN, updating your UPN should address that.
Now, one thing about the proxy. Proxy should change. However, the old proxy will also be added to the user as an additional email address. And that is because if that user sent out an email to somebody at Gmail, when the person at Gmail after UPN has been changed replies, then if that email address was not there anymore, then they would get an NDR. So I don't know if that's maybe what you're seeing. Maybe it's confusing that email address is still there. That email address will stay there and you want it to stay there, but the new one should show up too.
Thank you.
Okay, we've got time for one more quick question. We have 2 minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. We just finished migrating from a parent hosted where they're hosting our exchange. We put 55,000 users in the cloud. Our situation runs into, there's a kind of a dead end SMTP device that receives occasionally financial information. Our Office 365 has been encrypting that, trying to send it to this dead end device, which dumps it out because it doesn't know how to de-encrypt it. So what I did is I set up a rule that sort of bypasses to those addresses that go there, and it bypasses the encryption. Is that the right way to go? Is there another way I should have done that?
That sounds completely fair. I might follow up with you offline and maybe we can talk through the scenario a little more. But yeah, that sounds fully reasonable.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks everybody for joining the session today. We have a couple of these left, so you can get one.